All right, welcome back to the second session of the class on Ecclesiastes here. We just began chapter 1 last session, reading the first verses that everything is pointless, utterly pointless, as the conclusion of Solomon's investigation. At the outset, he throws that up front, that this is where he lands at the end of it all. And then he poses and sets before us his actual question that he's on the quest to answer. What does a man gain from all his toil at which he toils under the sun? And as I shared last time, the focus is on the word gain. He's asking, what does a person gain? This gaining idea isn't just about the accumulation of, if you go to work, you get a paycheck, that's gain. Or if you stack some bricks on top of each other, you build a house, that's gain. That's not the type of gain he's talking about. He wants to know, is there something that a person can do that actually has lasting ultimate value and benefit that actually changes the status quo of life? So as we begin to move into verse 4 here, he's going to now offer and set before the reader a set of proofs. In verse 4, he says, "A generation goes and another generation comes, but the earth remains forever." There's this temporality to a generation. One comes, and then it leaves. And then another one comes, and then it leaves. If we would look back even over the past century, we see that there are generational changes. We can go from the oldest group into the baby boomer group, to the Gen X group, the Gen Y group, the Gen Z group, and the generations will keep coming and will keep going, and there will be no end to them. This is what Solomon's point is that life just keeps on going. There does never seem to be any up or down to it, just a cycle of generations over and over. However, against that, he puts creation, such as the earth, that it is just immobile. It stays there, remains the same. That while there's this cycle happening with human life, the terrestrial earth under the sun just seems to be static, just seems to kind of just be there as something, as like a stable sort of foundation upon which the rest of activity of life happens. He's going to go through several of these proofs, all kind of proving the same point. The next one he points out is that it's the sun. If we look in the sky, he says the sun also rises and the sun sets. And panting returns to its place where it rises. So he goes from looking at human life to then looking at the bodies, the celestial bodies in the sky. And he's talking about the sun. Every day, he says, you look, the sun rises, goes across the sky, and sets. The next day, the sun rises, goes across the sky, and sets. It's like this. Day in, day out, week after week, and month, and year, and century, and millennia. And this is just what it does. Doesn't seem to change. There's no higher, bigger sun that grows. It's always just the same sun traversing the sky. So it's the cycle of the sun that shows the pointlessness of the activity. Verse 6, going toward the south and circling toward the north. Circling is the wind. And on its own circuits, the wind returns. So moving with this theme of nature, he goes from the sun to then the wind. And he is addressing what we know today to be the prevailing winds or the trade winds, the winds that have very definitive patterns to them around the earth, that the winds will move in one direction, will turn, go around, and move back to the place they were before. Just doing this circular motion, always, in every day, all day, just kind of going around in a circle. The cycle of the wind is never ending and never changing, just always doing the same thing. Verse 7, all the streams. So now he looks to the earth at water that go into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the streams flow, they return to flow again. We know this to be the water cycle, that Rain comes down from the sky, gathers together into a river. The rivers flow downhill and drain into a body of water. For example, like the sea or a lake or things like that. And then it gets evaporated, goes back up in the sky. Water keeps on draining in, just keeps on flowing, evaporating, come down, rain flows, evaporation, condensation, rain flows over and over again. It always just seems to be the same old, nothing changes. So in verse 8, he switches and now he goes to the human experience. He looks at nature, says, you see all these things, all this activity. Nature is bustling around every day, all day, just so busy, 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 busy. But what is it actually doing? Nothing. It's pointless. It's just activity for the sake of activity. Now, in verse 8, with the human experience, he says, all things are full of weariness. A person cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. Here he is addressing the unending human curiosity. People's eyes are never fully satisfied. There's always something more to see. Same thing with their ears. There's always something more to hear. They've heard one person speak, they'll listen to another person speak. Over and over, the ear is never satisfied. A person can always listen to more and more and more. And it's not just about the sense of seeing something or hearing something. It's really about human curiosity. It's about that when people have something in their mind that they're curious about, they go to seek to answer it. But then they begin this quest to answer it. And no matter how hard they look, no matter what answers they find, it actually is never enough. There's never an end to the quest. The curiosity, if an answer is found, another one rises up and takes its place, and then the quest begins all over again. And so where knowledge is concerned, there's really no end to it. There's actually no ultimate satisfaction. Human curiosity is an unending cycle. One answer is found, another question arises, the answer is found, another question arises, and so on it goes, over and over again. Verse 9, what has been is what will be. And what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. There is a thing about which one might say, look, this is new. But it already was in ages ago that came before us. Solomon's observation about the nature of development and progress is that there is none. There's nothing really that actually changes. It's wearisome because everything stays the same. Even has a little irony here. He says, somebody might think there's something new, something never before done or seen, or it's new. But he's like, yeah, right. It's not. It's been there. See, the thing is, even if you think it's new because you've either, you were ignorant of it to begin with, or you didn't take notice of it, and now you're first perceiving it, that doesn't mean anything is ever new because you're now just first perceiving it. If it's been there, it's been there. And you're just becoming aware of it doesn't actually give it the quality of being new. He says, what has been is what will be. And then what has been is what will be. And that's just going to be the way things go. There's like a cycle of history here. You guys have heard the phrase that history is bound to repeat itself. That's exactly Solomon's point, is that there's nothing new in human life that somehow is not been there before. Life is the way life has been. And this is, I think, maybe most appropriate with regard to like scientific discoveries. Scientific discoveries are never actually really something new that gets discovered. It's just bringing to awareness something that perhaps was not before noticed or seen, or the capability to perceive it was not available. Technologies have now been developed for us to be able to observe things that are far below the resolution of the human eye, or in places where humanity is not able to actually traverse and personally experience directly. A good example might be in 1990, we launched a massive telescope into outer space called the Hubble Telescope. And this enabled humankind to see deeper and farther into space than ever before. And they discovered new galaxies as though it was like, wow, this is new, but they've always been there. We just couldn't see them with the naked eye. And when you discover something and it's like, oh my gosh, look at this new thing. how does that actually affect life? If something's new in Solomon's eyes, new means life has actually changed for the better, is what he's looking for. Is there a gain in life because of these discoveries? Anything actually different about life than what was there previously? Sure, we find new things all the time, and we find new ways of doing things all the time, but everything new has always been there. It might just be we've combined things in a new way, or we just think it's new because we forgot that actually it was done before, and now we're rediscovering it, or just new ways of doing the same old trick. This is what technology does, allows us to do the same thing, just in different ways. There's nothing new about life, it's just different in the way we go about it. If we want to take, for example, pictures. In the old days, you had to take something and draw on a medium, like maybe on a rock in the really, really old days, in a cave somewhere, and then on maybe a piece of canvas with paint. You know, if you wanted a picture of yourself and your family, you paid somebody, you sat there, and for a couple hours or so, they painted you. And then all of a sudden, film was developed, was invented, and you could develop a picture that represented in some sort of 2D graphical fashion what were your family and your friends and whoever took the picture. And then we developed further beyond that to digital photography now. Now you can take pictures and actually see them on a screen and manipulate them. You don't have to develop them on actual photographic paper. Well, what happens if in the future we end up having holographic photography? Is that new? When we can now actually do like a 3D rendering of somebody with light? Or take cooking, for example. In the old days, you cook over an open fire. Then stone brick oven you cooked in to contain the heat. Then gas electric oven. So you didn't have to start a fire. You didn't have to go through that trouble of actually having flame and everything. Then we used radiation. A microwave oven. And who knows? Maybe we're going to go on to nuclear ovens. I mean, we're just cooking food here, right, folks? It's all the same. Life is all the same, just we're going about it differently. That's what technology does for us. Verse 11 says, there's no recollection of the former things. And also there will be no recollection of those things that are still to come by those who will come after them. So while nothing's ever new, Solomon says, also, nothing ever really lasts and people don't remember it. Everything basically gets forgotten. Whatever has happened, people in the past, we don't know about it as well. Our memory fades. Our clarity of what it was sort of like becomes fuzzy. And then what he's saying is that people in the future, with the things that happened then, the same thing will happen. Nothing actually remains. Nothing will be remembered. All right. In verse 12, it begins a new section. Verse 12 begins the actual quest. So up to this point, Solomon's been presenting us with sort of these proofs of like, why is it that everything is pointless? He sees in nature the cyclical aspects of the world, that all this activity is happening, but yet nothing's really making a difference because of it. He looks at the human experience. People are hearing and looking. Everything seems to just be this cycle. And memory comes and memory goes. Things are experienced and then forgotten. All this is just a pointless cycle. So that's the proofs he sets forth. Now he wants to discuss how he's going to be going about his quest of investigating, is there a gain for a man with all the work, all the toil he does under the sun? So, verse 12, I, the sage, here we're again, the King Solomon, the sage, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under the heavens. It is a burdensome business that God has given to the sons of men to be busied with. Solomon says, I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under the heavens. Under the heavens is just another way to say under the sun. The heart in the biblical culture was considered to be the center of the person. It was everything that made up who they are. And so what Solomon is conveying is that he did not pursue this question half-heartedly. It was with his entire being that he applied himself to the task. And not only just his entire self, like physically, he says he did it by wisdom. This means it wasn't an aimless or some sort of spontaneous endeavor or a whimsical mental exercise, but rather it was very calculated, very intentional. He went about it with a purposeful attitude that this needs to be done by wisdom, needs to be done the right way. As we read about in 1 Kings, Solomon had been blessed with great wisdom by God. And this was more than just common sense or knowledge. Solomon was skilled. He was skilled in studying. He was skilled in remembering. He was skilled in discernment, application of knowledge, diligence. He applied himself and everything that he was to investigate the experiences of different activities that occur among humankind. And he didn't happen to just find himself in these experiences. Rather, he was intentional and systematic about these experiments that he ran to try to discover the answer. And he observed the fullness of what life had to offer. By emphasizing this thoroughness and the methods of his investigation, Solomon's claiming that this investigation that he's going to lay out in the book of Ecclesiastes and his conclusions that everything is pointless is a reliable conclusion that does not permit any exception or perhaps reversal if further discoveries are made, because he's trying to claim comprehensive evaluation of the data. And therefore, the results will be entirely reliable, he's saying. Solomon the Sage expresses this quest to be one that is unavoidable. He says that it's a burdensome business that God has given. This is something that he sees as being divinely bestowed. The task of investigating everything under the heavens, he actually, though, puts quite a negative spin on it here. He says it's burdensome. This is a burdensome business. The actual word here, it kind of means bad or evil. It's kind of an unfortunate business or a not so good business to have to do, he says. It's tiresome, wearisome. He understands that the extent of the effort involved is immense. And he knows that searching for the meaning of life and the question that he poses is not going to be an easy feat. Well, what's his diagnosis then? If his desire is to apply himself wholeheartedly, everything he has been blessed with, all of his resources and mental faculties, his emotions and attitudes all in, that's his desire and the way he's approaching the task, then here we have his diagnosis of, this is kind of in a nutshell sort of what he initially is setting before the reader. I've seen all the works that are done under the sun, he says. And behold, yet again, everything is pointless and hurting the wind. He adds on here this phrase, hurting the wind. This idea of hurting the wind, you could think of it as he's trying to have the wind be sort of like, get his arms around the wind, be able to encase the wind. The Hebrew word refers to actually tending to a flock often, or shepherding a flock. So the idea of trying to keep all the sheep in together, we have an expression in America about herding cats. If you say doing something is like herding cats, that means it's extremely difficult to have it happen, because as soon as you get a cat and then you let it go and then you go get another one, it's gone. Just kind of runs all over the place. Well, think of the wind as something that's elusive. And Solomon is saying that it's like trying to herd together something that you just actually really can't get your arms around. You can't actually grasp. It's the wind. It just slips through your fingers. So everything's pointless and is like the wind slipping through your fingers. You can never actually really hold on to it. It's never really something that you can grasp. And so this has an overtone here of the Hebrew word translated pointless as kind of like it's almost absurd, or it's beyond really comprehension. It's just everything under the sun there's nothing to really be understood by it. It's like hurting the wind. There's nothing there to get. And then he gives a kind of a proverbial statement here in verse 15. He says, what is bent cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. Have you guys ever taken, I think about aluminum foil and cellophane. Now, aluminum foil, you could say perhaps when you get a nice, clean piece of aluminum foil, and then you crinkle it, and then you try to like smooth it back out, the creases never go away. Once you crinkle the aluminum foil, it's wrinkled. You crinkle it, it's wrinkled. You can't flatten it back out. Now, maybe if you like got a hot iron and like melted it and everything like that, maybe you could do that. But for the sake of illustration, you do something that it's really hard to ever undo it. Same thing with like cellophane. You pull the cellophane out, you get ready to put it over top of a dish in the kitchen. You pull it off and it just kind of like kind of sticks to itself. And then you do the best to try to pinch it and open it up, but you're never able to get it back nice and flat again like it was before. There are certain things that what happens when you bend them or something happens to them is it's there. You can never really go back to the original. And Solomon's saying that's kind of the condition of the world. The world is bent. The world has some defect in it, and there's no way to iron it out. There's no way to change it. You can't throw it away and get a new one. There's a permanent condition in the world. And not only a defect, but there's a deficiency. The second part here, he says, what is lacking cannot be counted. He's describing the world here as somehow missing a part, that the world is lacking something, and therefore you can't actually count it. You can't count what is never there to be counted. So he's saying that there is some incompleteness to the world. It's defective and it's deficient. And that's just the way it's going to be, he says. In verse 16, let me say one more thing about this proverbial statement in verse 15. Solomon's making two points here. One, that all activity and all human lifestyles are basically pointless, and that nothing can be changed about the world. He saw that even in his efforts to understand the world, that he could not fix it. Nobody can fix it. Even in his great wisdom, he saw through all the facades of the world of things that seemed like they could be remedied. But he's like, no, there is no effort. There's nothing that can be done to change this cyclical sort of endemic problem. No amount of effort or energy can be infused in the world to fix the problem. Everything's pointless, and there's no ultimate meaning to anything under the sun. So with these two premises in mind, he then kind of goes on to sort of despair about the whole thing. In verse 16, he says, I said to myself, behold, I've magnified and increased in wisdom above all who were over Jerusalem before me. Yes, my heart has seen much wisdom and knowledge. I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and foolishness. I perceived that this also was hurting the wind. He addresses two more yet unfortunate realities, that knowledge and wisdom, even though he got them all, he realized they didn't actually have any point either, which this is one of those proverbial things where you think, I thought wisdom was a good thing. Why is Solomon despairing that he has all this wisdom? Well, if we think about what he's trying to say about his quest, he's saying with all this wisdom and with all this knowledge, it didn't change anything. He's still the same Solomon he was before he got the wisdom and knowledge, ultimately speaking. In a grand scheme of things, the wisdom and knowledge didn't give him any gain in life. And in the quest, it didn't help him change anything about what he saw under the sun. And not only this, he has a very bad outlook, or I could say a very pessimistic outlook on knowledge and wisdom. Verse 18, he says, for in much wisdom is much frustration, and he who increases knowledge increases pain. The constant desire and pursuit of wisdom and knowledge, he's saying, leads to frustration and pain. You can't know what you need to know by just looking under the sun. Solomon's saying, if I have all this knowledge and understanding of the world, all it does is lead me to frustration and pain because I don't understand the whole by the parts. Knowing everything about the world doesn't lead to actual joy. Knowing everything doesn't lead to peace in one's life. Knowing everything doesn't lead to stability and safety. The constant increase in knowledge and wisdom only brings more difficult and complex questions to life, which produce more frustration, more anxiety, and more discouragement. The more progress that is made, it seems that it just only shows what more is to be done. If we say, let's go outside the Earth's atmosphere, let's go to outer space, we did it. Well, let's go to the moon, we did it. Well, let's build a space station, we did it. And now let's go to Mars, we'll probably do it. All it does is just show there's more and more yet to come, and it leaves one dissatisfied. Where is the accomplishment where people are like, yes, we have arrived? It doesn't exist. The search for knowledge doesn't change anything in life. It just rewards the seeker with deeper desires to search more until they're finally exasperated and understand that there's really no end to it. Science and philosophy are two pursuits of knowledge that never really find resolution or ultimate gain. It's never enough with what you discover in the world. You can understand all the wonderful intricacies of something only to realize that you're just at the beginning of that journey. You're at the tip of the iceberg, and that just breeds more discouragement and depression. The more you seek, Solomon says, the more it will hurt. I want to end with a quote from C.S. Lewis that kind of relates to this idea of the desires that humans have and the desires that Solomon had to seek all these answers and to try to understand the end of it all, only to right now describe his frustration and dissatisfaction with everything. In Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis writes that the Christian says creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists. A baby feels hunger. Well, there's such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. Well, there is such a thing as water. Men feel sexual desire. Well, there is such a thing as sex. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfy it, that does not prove that the universe is a fraud. Probably, earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy it, but only to arouse it, to suggest the real thing. If that is so, I must take care, on the one hand, never to despise or to be unthankful for these earthly blessings, and on the other, never to mistake them for the something else of which they are only a kind of copy or echo or mirage. I must keep alive in myself the desire for my true country, and I must never let it get snowed under or turned aside. I must make it the main object of life to press on to that country and to help others to do the same. It's my hope in this class on Ecclesiastes that as we go through Solomon's journey and the frustrations that he experiences and encounters along the way, and then finally reach his explanation at the end, that it'll help us understand C.S. Lewis's perspective that there is something more, and we want to understand how the meaning of life relates to the greater purpose that God has given to his creation. So we'll see you next time for the next session on the book of Ecclesiastes. Thank you.